भद्रं कर्णे विश्वनुयाम देवाः भद्रं पश्ये माक्षभिर्यजत्वाः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः व्यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। We're on verse 17. Prapancho yadi vidyeta, prapancho yadi vidyeta, nivarteta na samshayaha, nivarteta na samshayaha, maya matramidam dvaitam, maya matramidam dvaitam, Advaitam paramartataha, Advaitam paramartataha, Prapanchaha yadi vidyeta, Nivarateta nasamshayaha, Maya matram idam dvaitam, Advaitam, Advaitam paramartataha. In the previous verse, it says, the jiva who is sleeping because of beginningless maya, right? Anadi mayaya suptaha yada jivaha prabhujate. When the jiva who is sleeping, suptaha, because of by means of maya, which is beginningless, right? When that jiva wakes up, then buddhyate, then what is known? The Atma, the Turiya Atma, which is Ajam, free from birth, Anidram, free from sleep, Aswapnam, free from dream. And dream counts for the birth, the waking, and the dream state. So that when one wakes up from this, when one wakes up from the sleeping, the one who's sleeping because of this beginningless Maya, when that one wakes up, then this Ajam, this one who's free from birth, you know, and free from deep sleep, and free from dream, and is non-dual, that one then is known. That's the verse. Then that one is known, and one wakes up. So now what is said is that prapanchaha yadi vidyeta, if this world that one wakes up from, if this prapancha, if this world exists, yadi means if, the prapanchaha, if this world actually exists, then nivarteta, then it must be negated. Then it would be negated. It has to be negated, right? If this world actually exists, then we have to get rid of it. There's no doubt about this. For there to be a dvaita, right? Because if there is this world, if this world is real, then for there to be non-duality, we have to negate this world, for there to be non-duality, because this dvaita world conflicts with advaita. In fact, if there is advaita, non-duality, and this world, that is dual. There's the non-dual self and the dvaita, the dual prapancha. And if that's so, then for there to be advaita, we have to remove this prapancha. Right? So it says, he says, if this prapancha actually exists, then na samshaya, there's no doubt, it has to be eliminated. Right? But then he says, maya matram idam dvaitam. But this prapancha is merely maya. This dvaita, this duality, is only maya. It's the advaita that is paramartata. Paramartataha means absolutely real. Now, this is the thing. If there is such a thing as advaita, as non-duality, for non-duality to be, the duality that we experience, the dvaita, so for advaita to be, The dvaita that we experience has to be of another order of reality. We can't have a dvaita of one order of reality and duality of the same order of reality. That won't work, because that is dual, right? That's dvaita, in fact. We have this non-dual self, and we have this dual creation. So the dual creation is dual in and of itself, and it's also dual in reference to the Atma. So you have the Atma and the creation. That's one, two. Okay? So we have the Atma, the one Atma, and then the second, dual creation. That itself is dvaita. For there to be advaita, you can't have that. It's either advaita or it's dvaita. If it's not non-dual, if there's something else that competes with it, that's not non-dual. So if we have a dual creation that is of the same order of reality as the non-dual, then there's no non-dual. So he says, if this creation, if this prapancha means the whole manifest creation, if this whole creation exists, if it actually exists, then it has to be eliminated. You know? But how can you eliminate? He says, Nasamshaya, there's no doubt about that. You can't have a dvaita and have this. But if this is maya, then there's no competition. Because satya mitya, the order of reality that maya enjoys, is mitya. Mitya is a different order of reality. That's why these orders of reality are so essential to understand, because otherwise dvaita competes with advaita. But if dvaita is mitya, then mitya is something which is, which has for its being the adhishtana, whatever it depends upon for it to be. And here the dvaita that we experience when we say it is mitya, that means it has no being of its own apart from what is satyam. So that's why these terms, satyam, mitya, and tucham, become so important. And you'll find that when this isn't understood, people are kind of jumping from different orders of reality, and it gets very, very confusing. But if this is understood, then this dvaita that you experience, if it is mitya, it doesn't compete with advaita. Advaita being satyam, the advaita is its very self. And so we have to look at it like this. I'm just going to run through this again so that we understand what these orders of reality mean. So if we say that something is satyam, sometimes satyam is translated as real, that which is real, or that which is true. Or, these are just different ways of wording it, that which actually is, or that which actually exists, that is satyam. And so what does it mean then for something to actually exist? It means it can't be negated in past, present, or future. It is. It does it come into being and go out of being? Because that would not be satyam. If it comes into being and go out of being, then it's bordered by non-existence. And so that's not real. Satyam means something that is the being itself. It's not subject to change or time. So the only thing that can qualify as satyam is Brahman. Because Brahman, conscious existence, consciousness which is existence, your very being, is not something that can be objectified to be subject to change, to have a beginning and end. So it's the conscious being that you are, which is called Brahman, which is just pure conscious being, that gets designated with this particular order of reality, that which never changes, that which is not subject to birth and death, that which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. There's nothing in the creation that can enjoy that order of reality that we call satyam. Because within the creation, within duality, everything is subject to change. Everything is subject to time. And so, if we were to say to somebody, is there anything that is satyam, that really enjoys this order of reality, satyam, in the creation? It means it's not subject to change, does it come into being, does it go out of being, can never be negated, it's free of time, basically. You'd have to say no. Nothing, no, because everything is subject to duality and subject to change. So there is no satyam in the creation. But then say, if you're from more Buddhist perspective, you go, see, I told you so. There's nothing in the creation which is real. There's nothing true. Everything is continually subject to change. Everything is interconnected. There is no real thing here. There is nothing satyam here. But the Vedantin would say, yes, that's true. Within dvaita, within duality, within time and space, the whole duality has time and space as its warp and woof. There is no satyam. Everything comes into being and goes out of being. Nothing enjoys this order of reality of satyam. But we would also say, this whole creation that we experience, which definitely is not satyam, you can't say that it's satyam. We also can't say it's tucham. We can't say it has no existence at all, because we experience. So experience it. And we're talking. Here we are engaged in it. So we have these two orders of reality. One is the absolute reality of satyam, and then tucham is the opposite. This is pure existence, changeless existence. Nothing enjoys that here. And also, everything that we experience here doesn't enjoy tucham. It's not no absolute non-existence either, because we experience it. And when it's here, we experience it. So you can't say this is non-existent, like the son of a barren woman, or a city in the sky, or horn of a rabbit. Those are three of the examples they use. Not tucham, it's not satyam. But then what is it? We have to categorize this as a different order of reality. Not satyam, not tucham. And we say that order of reality is mitya. Mitya means we do experience it, we acknowledge that, but then upon inquiry, if we experience it, and so you can't say it's tucham. We can't also say it's satyam. So it's not satyam, it's not tucham. You know? And that's its basic definition. Sat asat bhyam anirvachaniya. It can't be categorized as sat, satyam, or as asat, tucham. That's what mitya is. That's a general definition of this order of reality. Okay? But then to say even further, is mitya, whatever is mitya, because it's not satyam and it's not non-existence, it's not absolute reality and it's not non-existence. Whatever it is enjoys satyam for its being. Because otherwise it would be non-existent. We experience it, so we have to give existence to it. But everything within mitya is subject to change. And so that means every experience is bordered by non-existence. Anything that changes, its prior condition is now gone. Right? And so anything changing really is bordered by non-existence, but it is existing when it is there. But for it to be existing when it is there, if it itself is bordered by non-existence, the existence which it is enjoying, right, is something that it must depend upon for it to be experienced, because it's not non-existent. And so we say, this world that is made of maya, remember when we do the etymology of maya? Ya ma iti maya. That which is not. Means upon inquiry, we can't find any substance here. The maya itself has no being. The being that maya has is Brahman, which is satyam. The being that maya has is being itself. Being itself is what we call Brahman, conscious being, which is limitless. It's not subject to, cannot be objectified. It's not my being, the conscious me that I am. I can't objectify this conscious being and look at it. Look at me as an object. Oh, here, look. Here, look at this conscious being here. Then it'd be easy to teach. You just pull some out, you know, and say, this is the conscious. Just pull your conscious being out. Take a look at it. You cannot do that. You can't do it, because if you could do that, then who's the one observing? Who's the one illumining that? And so you can't objectify yourself, but because your being is consciousness, that very lit up, self-evident me, you know, it doesn't need to be objective to be objectified to be known, because you are conscious being itself. And this conscious being that I am is the self of anything that is mitya. Means anything, and mitya is that order of reality right? Which this whole Maya, everything, Maya means everything that exists within time and space, is this projection of what we call Maya. And Maya, we say Maya because it's just a word, really, to account for this world that we are experiencing. But when we analyze this world that we're experiencing, we can't find anything here. So it's all Maya. As you analyze it, it disappears. As you research into it, you know, go in to try to find out something there, you just, it's names within names within names within names endlessly. And if you were to take away the name, we say names and forms within forms within forms within forms, and you have to take off that final form, and then there's no sense organs to see it. The Swamiji doesn't say forms anymore. He just says names within names within names, because really they are all names of Brahman. Because what is actually here, the very being of Maya, because Maya has no being of its own, so the being it enjoys is that non-objectable, non-objectifiable, changeless me. And so, as that becomes understood, this dvaita, there is no need to remove it so that there can be a dvaita. This is a dvaita. This is non-duality. Because the substance, what is actually here, is only one. You would have to be able to establish a second thing in the same order of reality. You would have to be able to tell me that this is not set, that this is not being, and this is not being, that this is not being, that this has a different, that this is a separate being, that this table has a being which is separate from the being that space has, and separate from the being that this table has, and this body has, and these clothes have, and these glasses have. And if I look up at the sky, it's a separate being than the sky has. But how are you going to divide conscious being when, in fact, when you're looking out at this, even at this room through your eyes, you see nama-rupa, name and form. But all of the name and form that you see enjoys being, which you don't see. The being you are. The being is self-evident. Right? And all names and forms that you experience are not away from that being. We don't think like that because of the identification with the body is so much, and with the sense organs. So my being in my mind stops at my body, but it doesn't stop at your body, because it doesn't stop at your body. The sat-chit doesn't stop at your body. Because is this table known, and does it have being? Oh yes, it does. How do you know it does? You give it being. You're not looking at being. You're not looking at existence. You give existence to everything, but existence, the being that you give it, is not objectifiable. You give consciousness to everything in the form of knownness. It is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. This isn't more known than this. The knownness is pervasive. It's homogeneous to whatever experience that you're having. It's not more knownness on this side than on this side, or up here or there. The whole thing enjoys one knownness, one consciousness. The whole thing, the totality of your experience, enjoys one being. So just because this body, mind, sense organs is a seer and this table is the seen, right? That doesn't mean that this table doesn't enjoy the same sat-chit that this body, mind, sense organs enjoys. You know, you think that the mind that is illumined, that has self-evident consciousness, that illumines this mind, is a different self-evident consciousness than illumines this table. But actually, this is one of the reasons why this Drikdrisha Viveka for Kriya, this teaching methodology, is so important. Because with this particular teaching methodology, what you do is you end up giving the you realize, right, without any work, every samsari knows this. This table is objectifiable. It is known. This chair is known. For some reason, we don't compute that the same sense organs that know this table and this chair know this body. If I remove my sense organs one by one, I remove my perception of the world as well as my perception of the body. So this body really enjoys the same order of objectivity. It is not any different in terms of objectivity than the table. My sense organs also, I think that they're not objectified. It's because of the sense organs that I know this body and everything else. So then I put the Atma, the conscious being, there in the sense organs. But then I have to realize the sense organs are also objectified. And if my mind is daydreaming, if it's daydreaming, the sense organs that are here are not being used. They're only instruments. So now the sense organs I recognize are also objectified. Then they belong here as part of Ishvara, as part of the creation. The subject-object seer-seeing differentiation starts becoming a little different. What happens is that the sat-chit, the conscious being that is me, the self, the conscious being, becomes differentiated now, not just from this world. The I, the me, gets differentiated from the body and the sense organs also, which are given over into the objectified world. And then I recognize the mind also is just an instrument. You know, instead of being a rock, it's like a mirror. It's still objectified. It's an objectified mirror instead of an objectified rock. See what I mean? Because the mind is the reflects consciousness or seems to enjoy consciousness, like a mirror seems to enjoy the sun more than the rock does. Just not really true. Right? Both are objectifiable objects. So the mind also is in that situation. So that now what I had made me a knower, the conscious being means a knower. It does, and before it was me, the conscious being is the knower, not me, the conscious being is the table. I'm only the knower. I'm not the table. I'm not the known. I'm only the knower. I'm not the known. But then I realize that the knower, the mind and the sense organs, is also an object. So we've got the objectified knower and the objectified known, both of which are illumined by me, which means I'm the self of the knower and I'm the self of the known. I am the conscious being because of which this universe enjoys sat-chit. Everything enjoys easily is. Every experience you have, it is. That's the sat. That's the being. What I don't realize is that every experience enjoys knownness. It enjoys consciousness. It is known, it is known, it is known, it is known. The body is known, the sense organs are known, the mind is known, the emotions are known. The perceptions are known. I can't have an experience that is not known. Which means I can't have an experience that is away from consciousness. Consciousness is the self. The sat-chit is the self, the being. The sat, the being, the changeless being of all experience. The sat-chit is satyam. That is what is real. Everything else comes and goes within sat-chit. Anything that comes and goes within sat-chit, conscious being, is mithya. It enjoys being and knownness when it is there. And when it's not there, it's gone. That's mithya. The whole order of reality that the entire creation enjoys, both in terms of the shared reality that we call vyavaharika, the empirical reality, vyavaharika satyam is empirical reality, or pratibhasika satyam, which means the imagined reality, subjective reality, not shared. You know, whatever I'm thinking, for instance, my own imagination, dream states, those are personal. If I see a snake on a rope and you don't, so subjective reality, all of that enjoys, all of that is mithya. It's all subject to continual change, but it has for its being sat-chit. So even though our experience within the world is so finite and so subject to continual coming and going, it is totally unstable. There's nothing here that is stable at all. It's always moving. But its being is totally stable. It couldn't be more stable. Conscious being is changeless. It's not playing the game within duality. It's not part of the continual movement of Maya. So the continual movement of Maya has the stable base of Satchit, which is Satyam, because it doesn't come into being and go out of being. It is the constant. And that constant is me. And so when we were doing the meditation, that's a Satyam Mitya type of meditation, where it's to highlight who you are really. If we're looking at anything that is mitya, that is coming into being and going out of being, any perception that's changing, anything like that, that experience has no being of its own. And the reason for that is that anything that changes goes out of existence. Whatever changed is no longer there. Whatever comes into being, it wasn't there before. And so that means that all of these experiences that we have no being, and yet they all have being, right? And so that is the relationship between mitya and satyam. They have being, but they have no being. Because they come from non-being, they go to non-being, but all the while they're there, they have being. But that doesn't make any sense. Nothing can come from non-being, but everything has been because I am that being. That is the truth. And that's not that truth, which is me, is non-objectifiable. Once you say non-objectifiable also, it doesn't have any parts because space is objectifiable, time is objectifiable, objectivity is objectifiable. And so the me, which is not objectifiable, is not big or small, it's not tall or short, it's not black or yellow or white or anything. It just is simply me. And I cannot, every experience that is there has me for its center and its peripheral. There is no experience which has any separation from me at all. But the difference is, in the order of reality, I always am exactly the same. And whatever is mitya has me for itself, but it comes and goes. It's continually changing, but the edges, the changes, right, never touch me. Because I'm not an objectifiable. I'm not changing within time and space. I'm the self of this mitya, of this maya. And so when we do this meditation, if you just sit, because it's we have so many notions about who the self is, and what enlightenment is, and what self-knowledge is, that I have to have a big awakening of some self, that I have to become very subtle to travel to have an ecstatic experience of the divine self, as opposed to this little self here. But that's not true. That is not what it is. What it is that this so-called little self here is the self. The one when you're sitting, just sitting, okay, here I am, this me that is this body. This me, this conscious being that I am, that is this body. It is that self. Now the thing we have, it's no other self. It is only that self. But now we have to see the satyam mitya. There is this body that is me, that enjoys me totally 100%. I am itself. But in my experience, I can differentiate the satyam mitya. Because this body, which is me, is changing, is growing, started out as a little baby, is now so many years, and even day to day is continually changing. And that changing body is changing in stable me. There's the changing within the changeless. Mind is very good to use for this because the body changes more slowly. But the me that is the body, This me that is the body, is the me that is the breath, is the me that is the sense organs, is the me that is the mind, is the me that is the emotions. But the emotions, the mind, the body, the sense organs, these are all mithya, because they're all subject to time, they're all subject to change. They're coming and going, the experiences are coming and going. But there's something that is absolutely stable, and that is what I identify always as me. When I say I am the body, the I is referring to me, the conscious being. When I say I am unhappy, that I, that the I is identifying with me, only me, the conscious being that is shrouded in unhappiness, or shrouded in agitation, mental states, or shrouded in joy, or shrouded in compassion, or shrouded in shanti. Whatever the mental state is, that is me. The me is the same. The me who is happy is the me, who is agitated is the me. These mental states and emotions negate each other. But they're all me. They're all me. The me isn't being negated. The mental states negate each other, which means that I can't be any of those mental states because I'm all of them. The mental states, emotions negate each other. The little baby body is not here anymore. The body totally changes over every 7 years. The baby body's not here anymore. The teenage body is not here. The elderly body is on its way. You know? But the me is the same. It's always the same. No matter what experience, what emotion you're having, the me is the same. So who is this me? You have to get to know yourself. Get to know yourself, the me that you take to be the body. Okay, what are you like? The me that is the mind that has all of these experiences. Okay, what are you like? And then I just want you to recognize one thing about yourself, and that is you never change. Emotional states change, thoughts change, body changes, roles in life change. Everything changes, but you remain the same. So this me that you take to be the body, that's what you take to be the body-mind complex, it is this very me that we meditate on. When you're doing meditation, look at what's happening. Unless your mind is going trying searching, which it probably is, until it learns not to do that. You know, what is happening is that you're just allowing yourself to be, you're turning the sense organs away from all of this noise, all of the static, looking outward and all of this external stuff, and then becoming aware of your physical body and just your own presence there, and then aware of your breath and your own presence there, aware of the thoughts in your mind, your own presence there, aware of your emotions, your own presence there, aware of your even the I thought, the ahamkara, your own presence there, and then all along just becoming, bringing into the gestalt, bringing into the forefront, or just your own simple presence. And then you start to know yourself. You ask, what am I like? Just the one who is present to all of these experiences. What is this self like? Because it is this self that is Brahman. Why is me, why is this me, the simple me, why do they say Satchit Ananda? You can say Sat, well, Sat because I am. Chit because I am self-evident. Not consciousness of anything. Just simple me. I am self-evident, self-shining. I don't need a pramana, means of knowledge, to come and light me up. I just simply am. Why do they call me, the simple me, Ananda? Because I'm not blazing with bliss or anything. Some bliss experience. Why am I Ananda? Then you ask yourself, well, is there anything more dear to me than me? You just see. Is there? Can you think of anything? Try to find something that is more dear to you than you. Why? And then you say, why is it so dear? Why is it so precious? It's really a beautiful meditation. What is so dear and so precious about it that there's nothing else competes with it? And that is why they call it Ananda. There is nothing more beloved. We're thinking, when we think of ananda, we translate it as bliss. And so we're looking for some joyful, blissful experiences. We're not focusing on what is really the meaning of the word ananda. That which is absolutely dear. But there's nothing more dear than that. There's nothing more valued than that. It's ananda, that which is completely full or whole. That which can't be improved upon in terms of what is priyam or what is most beloved to me. That's why it's called ananda. And then you try to find something else. And once you start realizing that, when you start really realizing, then your mind starts to, because we're not used to it, to the truth of it. But as you start to understand, then your mind becomes more and more revels in that. In just kind of the sanctity of, or whatever words, no words really work, because these aren't relative concepts. But that which is most dear is never away from you. Right? And it's never away from any of your experience either. That's the thing. Because you aren't away from any of your experience. And the self that you are is really the self of all beings. The self of the table, it's the self of the cat, it's Tibby's self. It's everybody's self. It's your pet self, it's your plant self. It's everybody. It is the self. You know? And that self that you are is not an objectifiable self to look at. Names within names within names are what are objectifiable. But yourself is the self of all of those things. You know? And so your mind stops searching for yourself or for that which is most beloved in something external. Because you are already that self. You already are the self of that external thing. You know, and so enjoying that self, you can enjoy Ishvara. That's what it is. In enjoying the mind reveling in yourself, you enjoy this creation as Ishvara. And then as a body, mind, sense organs, as a jiva in this creation, which is Ishvara, it's a wonder, and you do what is to be done based upon your prarabdha karma. And you engage in the creation and try to, you know, do your best. Be helpful. Do what is to be done. Swamiji says, I just do what is to be done every moment. In the situation, it's all kinds of tumultuous situations. It's all kinds of situations. That is Ishvara. And so if you're objective and not trying to make them be the source of your ananda, which they need, they're not anyway. In fact, what takes away your ananda in terms of mental states is you're trying to make them the source of your ananda, and then the poor mind gets all disheveled and upset. You know, if you're not trying to do that, then, you know, this is your karma, this is your prarabdha, and then your task is to try to be helpful. You know, try to make it better for yourself and others. And if you can't do that, then that's your sadhana. Because the only reason because that's what's natural for you to do. That's what's natural for us. Because the self that we are is whole and complete and benign. It's the nature of the Atma, of your being. And so when our mind isn't expressing that, it's because something's upsetting us. You know, something's hurting us, something's upsetting us. And that has its roots in ajnanam. And so we have lifetimes of that. And so as we find ourselves behaving in the world as this, I'm sorry, getting upset about this or mad about that, or, you know, insulted about that or hurt about that, or all the things that we're capable of, then those are just sadhanas. You know, we work and see, well, what's really going on with that, with the little ones inside doing, who's hurt, who just needs some help, you know? And then, you know, what is it that's bothering me out here? And then try to figure it out relatively, what's going on, and then bring your knowledge in. And that's what we do. Because what else would we do? It's just, you can't blame your mind or be mad at your mind for, you know, not adjusting itself immediately after beginningless lifetimes of jnanam, you know, and having parents that are jnanis and having a culture that's in Kali Yuga and, you know, all kinds of duality and difficulties. And so the mind has created problems for itself, and it takes it a while to work all of that out. But as you're clear in your, as you know yourself, you know, as your mind is working through all of these complexes and habits, habitual thinking and all of that, it's doing that with you. In your presence, with your blessing, and with your buddhi that has knowledge. And that knowledge takes care of you and the habits and the hurts, as well as the world, you know? It's like the buddhi, your knowledge, and just the continual presence, the shining presence of your being, you know, helps the buddhi to take care of you, your body, mind, sense organs, with all of the complexes and things and areas of growth that need to take place. And also blesses you and blesses the world. You know, not expecting perfection. You know, the self is perfect. We're all scrambling around, doing our best. So the crux of this verse is that this dwaita world, it's only mitya. It's not two. You know, it's not like there's turiya, the self, and the world that has to be gotten away, gotten rid of. This world is mitya. It's only maya, maya matram. That literally means that, maya matram. It's only, matram means only. It's merely maya. Idam dwaitam, this world is merely maya. There's nothing to be gotten rid of here. Because there's no, with maya, there is no second thing. So he says, if this prapancha really existed, if this world really existed, then yes, we'd have to get rid of it. But it's only maya. Duality is only maya. The only thing real here is advaita. So there's no getting rid of anything. There is nothing to get rid of. See what I mean? You can't get rid of something that's not there. You see what I mean? So it's not about dwaita and advaita. There is only advaita. This is maya, for it's mitya. So it's not there to be gotten rid of as a second thing. Well, amazing verse. Yeah. Okay, stop there. Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha Harihi Om.
So here I thought, all these so-called faults or complexes that I needed to embrace really don't even exist.
not in the same way that yourself does, anyway. Right. They exist there relatively and can be handled relatively. But they don't add or subtract from your own being. And that's the beautiful thing, too. once that's different, yourself is differentiated out, then you can handle all of these things and work on all of these things, which are natural. You know, just like if your leg is broken, you want to go and fix it. If your mind is creating pain, then you want to fix it. It calls for you to fix it. But yourself, the presence of your being is there always in the same way. And it becomes such a refuge. It is anyway, it is the very self of Nitya anyway. But when the mind is awake to it, then your being is its refuge. It is its home. You know? And it can always dive in, so to speak, and refresh itself. Not that it, for you, your own presence in terms of gestalt becomes more and more into the forefront. It's always in the forefront anyway, but from the standpoint of the mind, it becomes more, your own presence is more and more the forefront. You know? And you are changeless. So it's such a relief for the mind.
Something is another order of reality. Mm-hmm. Just that term feels to me like a little bit like a shortcut around a logical problem, you know, to just say, oh, well, it's a different order of reality. That's why there's no conflict.
Tell me more.
And so, I don't know, I was thinking, I mean, and not the explanation itself, but just that term, saying that something's a different order of reality. So I'm trying to understand exactly what that means, I guess, like...
Well, like, it means it's simple, actually. Like, if there's a rope on a snake on a rope, the snake is a different order of reality than the rope, right? If I have an imagination, as real as that imagination is from within itself, it's a different order of reality than this waking state.
Right, that's what I was going to ask about, like a dream. So a dream is a different order of reality.
Yes.
Even then... Mitya, though, in a way. Like,
no, the dream is mitya, too.
Yes, but it's different.
But it's pratibhasika. Mm-hmm. See, within mitya, you have two orders of reality. One is vyavahara. Mm-hmm. Vyavahara is the reality that we share, science.
Right.
Pratibhasika is the projected reality. Mm-hmm. So any projection, imagination, thoughts, these are all pratibhasika, because they're a projection like snake on a rope, that's pratibhasika. Because... it's coming out of my subject. It's subjective, but both are mitya.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But now you're still not clear, though. We're not clear.
Yeah.
Now, what do you mean by like kind of an escape, or what did you say?
It just seems like a shortcut because it's like it just seems like a way of dismissing something to say that it's another order of reality. I don't know how to...
But it shouldn't be a dismissal, because then that's like a bypass.
Right, that's how I feel
yeah.
about it.
No. We don't want you to feel that way. So let me explain a little bit more. This body, mind, sense organs, world, Ishwara, science, all of this is the same order of reality, right? And so within this order of reality, there's Dharma, and adharma, there's pleasure, there's pain, you know, there's science, there's laws, there's the way the mind works, the emotional system works, right? And all of that being true, that all of that duality is taking place and has for its being a self which is changeless. That's a fact. So you can, even in the Katha Upanishad, I think in the Bhagavad Gita, there's two, both of these is a very similar verse, the one who thinks that he is the killer or the killed, that one does not know.
Mm-hmm.
Because the self is neither the killer nor the killed. So they're using the most extreme example that they can to show that the Atma is free of duality. It's free of Dharma, it's free of Adharma, it's free of pleasure, it's free of pain. It is just Ananda, Satchit Ananda. So now that can be an escape if you think that your mind can escape it, just saying, oh, this terrible act that I did is only mitya, that doesn't make any difference. Well, that's true from the standpoint of the Atma, but from the standpoint of the mind that committed that, or the person that committed that adharma, there is no escape from the pain that that causes, or the adharma that it causes. So it's like, just like the body, if the body is ill, even though the atma is not ill, the body is ill and is in pain, and so needs to be treated like that. And so you can't really bypass pain. You can go ahead and say the pain is mitya, and if that's good enough for you, that's fine. And I can also say, and in a way, if you we're not talking about dharma and adharma, and you say, your mind is in pain, you say, well, this pain is mitya. If that's helpful for you, fine. But often pain is something that there's a reason for that pain. And so we would want to solve that problem. If the reason for the pain is because of fundamental ajnanam, then self-knowledge will solve the problem. But a lot of times the reason for emotional pain is on one level self-ignorance. On another level, it's childhood hurts, you know, or I'm oriented incorrectly with the world and behaving in the world in a way that creates pain for myself and others. And those things have to be handled on a relative level.
And how long will that process go on? Or, I mean, can that be the whole lifetime? Or would you say it satisfies itself?
You know, if you have a lot of childhood traumas that are causing a lot of pain inside, they just have to be worked with properly for as long as they have to be worked with. It's the same thing there. You can't say, well, it's going to take, you know, 1 year, 5 years, or 10 years. We can't really say that. It just depends upon what the issues are. One thing, though, is as you gain knowledge, the working on these issues it's totally different. You're still working on the issues, but at least you have yourself, which is there, you know, as a benign and beautiful, free support, someone who is whole and free, that is there present to all of these issues that we're working on. It's natural to work on issues. If the issues are causing you pain, then it's natural for you to work on them.
Because they can almost seem like an endless jungle of events like that.
Would it be on the same level as Prarabdha or not?
The Prarabdha karma can have a lot of difficulties in your life because of the Prarabdha karma. But how you are in the midst of those difficulties is up to you, really, and your assimilation of your knowledge and your own dharma, adharma, how you handle the difficult situations. Difficult situation can be handled objectively, you know, or they can be handled very subjectively. It just depends on your orientation. I mean, everybody can handle happy situations, more or less. It's the hard, it's the difficult set of situations that require a shift in attitude. And even without knowledge, more mature person can handle the very difficult situations with more objectivity than, say, a less mature person. But they're still difficult. And a jnani can handle the situation perhaps much more objectively than another person, but it's still a difficult situation. It's meant to be difficult. It's not a pleasing situation. You know?
In my week, the term spiritual bypass was spoken of. I'm thinking of a shortcut that doesn't work.
That's what we were just talking about, a spiritual bypass. Spiritual bypass is when you try to get over some limitation that you're having by just saying, oh, it's all mitya anyway. You know? There's a reality to some things where you can accept things as they are and let them go. You know? There's a certain freedom to be able to do that. But if you can do that, then that's fine. But that's certainly not always the case. Mm-hmm. You know? You can't let them go. And so you try to maybe bypass in this and that way, but it's still there. You know? it becomes like a, I don't know, not very real. You know, it doesn't work in any meaningful way.
You know, I'm just reading the Mahabharata, you know?
Mahabharata.
Yeah, you say Mahabharata, huh?
Mahabharata.
Mahabharata.
It's not that I say it. That, no, no.
We did that Saturday.
Mahabharata.
Mahabharata.
Bharata.
Okay. Mahabharata.
But people won't know what you're talking about when you say it that way.
Mahabharata.
It's hard.
I bet that's come over that way, but it's not how it's spelled.
Yeah.
Mahabharata.
It's interesting. I think it's sometimes a wrong transliteration also.
Maybe.
Yeah, anyway, I'll show you the book.
Okay.
But anyway, what's interesting is in the story is, besides it being such a drama, you know, it's kind of, it seems like the exaggerated drama of what we're living here, right? You know, it's kind of like...
That's these itihasas, like the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. They show these archetypal extreme situations that play out over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, that's why it's so amazing.
But you know what's so interesting is, like, with all the injustice and everything that happens there, there's still, it's, you know, it's, anyway, I can't even describe it. It's just, like, so complex. But it's like so, it's so deep in terms of I just kind of notice that there's a certain quality of acceptance, you know, that plays a big role. Like the Pandavas, for example, you know, they play this role. They're accepting so much. There's so much stuff that comes at them, where you just wonder sometimes, wow, it's like, how do they do that, really? You know, because it. It's just this kind of Maya, right, that they're kind of living out there in this story. But it's like, where is this capacity coming from, taking so much, being put down in so many kind of ugly ways, you know, and then transforming that, and it's like, what's the reality of that? You know what I mean? It's like...
Well, I mean, they also live within a real understanding of Dharma and Niti.
Yeah.
And so this is really, you know, just one scene after another of how to handle these situations dharmically.
Yeah.
So that's what the Ramayana and Mahabharata are about. How to handle all of these life situations and all these emotions even. How to handle them in a dharmic way. And it just gives example after example after example of very extreme situations and how to be in that.
Yeah.
Along with all of your emotions and everything. That's what's so beautiful about it. They don't try to make you not have any feelings or emotions. Because the Pandavas and, you know, Sita and Rama and all of them, they have a full scale, you know, the full set of emotion.
So deep.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. I got so much out of it when I read through that. I'd like to do that again if I could just get into that habit of reading a chapter so every night.
In English or Sanskrit?
I read it in English, though I keep going back and forth to the Sanskrit. My vocabulary Sanskrit vocabulary is so huge that every time you change centuries or change topics, you have a new, hundreds of new words.
Uh-huh.
So I'm very full vocabulary in Vedanta. And okay for that, but I'll read it in English usually. It's faster. I'd love to be able to sit there and just read it in Sanskrit. That would be such a joy. But I didn't ever put in that much time to be able to do that.
It was presented to India in the film of it.
Oh yeah, I've seen it.
And in Bali, it was extremely popular. And the whole island just stopped and everybody watched it.
Yeah.
And I watched it too. And it was so dramatic.
That's amazing. You know,
like the television show? Or
yeah, television. Well, it was serialized. I mean, it was...
Yeah, yeah. It goes on for a long, long time.
Yeah, it went on for a long time.
Yeah. But, you know, they'll have bards go around in India who will sing the whole Mahabharata. Mm-hmm. It'll take days and days, and people will just sit for 8 hours a day.
Yeah,
the whole village
shows up.
Yeah, it's just, when you go through the whole thing, and this is like 18 volumes, it's just beautiful. And Swamiji taught it to us. also he went through the whole Mahabharata and Ramayana, but he would read a lot of it in Sanskrit, but then tell the story, and then take another Sanskrit section and tell. But he would tell the whole story. Mm-hmm. We have that on tape, actually. I used to love listening to it. He's such a good storyteller.
Wow.
Yeah, he said the whole Ramayana and the Mahabharata.
But there's so many characters. Can you keep the flow going?
Well, that's hard at first. You get used to it.
That's not available, though, right?
Swamiji's?
Yeah,
it's available.
Yeah.
I have it.
His stories?
Yeah, I have it.
Wow.
Yeah, I give it to anybody if you want it.
On tape, like the kind of tapes?
MP3s, not in tapes.
Oh.
You all have to graduate up to the MP3.
Now, when you said tapes, I was like, really?
It's a whole Mahabharata. Mahabharata.
Well, he told the whole story.
Yeah.
Right, but it's not in detail all of the different parts.
I understand.
Yeah.
Some quintessences.
Yeah. Wow. It's beautiful. It's wonderful to listen to it. I have all the 18 volumes in English and in Sanskrit, and in Sanskrit English, and I have the Ramayana in English and Sanskrit in English.
So the Ramayana I thought it was part of the Mahabharata.
No. Actually, I think in the Mahabharata they have a condensed Ramayana in the Mahabharata. So yeah, just a very condensed, condensed. Yeah, but the Ramayana itself is
so it's really
two
separate
volumes.
Or is it part of that whole story?
No, it isn't.
It's really separate.
Yeah, it's separate. Yeah, it's separate. It's supposed to with a different yoga apparently.
Hmm. A different time period.
Yeah,
different. So different characters.
Totally different characters.
Oh,
yeah.
So it's really different.
Yeah. No, let's stop.